Progressive voice of Minnesota here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. It is a Friday edition of the show as we are jam-packed with a couple of great interviews that are going to be on the way today. Coming up, we are going to be talking about TikTok. No, not just how you can make cool videos on TikTok. No, we're going to be talking about the regulatory aspect of that brand new social media app. Could the Trump administration ban TikTok? And if so, how would they go about doing that? Because you can't just go and willy-nilly say as the president, oh, this app is banned. It's a lot more complicated than that. And then also, what would happen if Microsoft were to buy TikTok? There could be some major regulatory impacts there, including another possible antitrust case against Microsoft. Remember that when that happened about 20 years ago? So that'll be a discussion we'll be having in the second half of the show with Adam Raziere, who is a social marketing expert on regulatory issues in regards to social media. So make sure you stay tuned for that in the second half of the show as we are going to be talking about social media regulation and more specifically TikTok. Also ahead on the show today, we are going to be talking about child care providers. That is an industry that has been hit really, really hard with the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, they have been able to get some government funding to help them through, but even with that funding, there are still lots and lots of issues that child care providers are going to be facing in the future, even if we get an economic recovery that comes quickly, which I'm very skeptical will happen. Donald Trump at least wants to talk about having a V-shaped downturn and uptick in economic activity. I don't think that's going to happen. We're probably going to be in for a slow recovery, and the child care industry is going to be impacted very, very hard. And, of course, that has an effect on everybody who has children because you generally end up paying an arm and a leg for child care services. And then even when you look at areas of rural Minnesota, there are cases where there are sometimes just one child care provider located in a city or sometimes even in a county. So coming up in just a few minutes, we are going to be talking with Walker Orenstein of MinnPost as he recently wrote a piece about what's happening with the child care industry in Minnesota. So we'll be speaking with Walker from MinnPost in a few minutes. Before we get to all of that, though, do want to go through some housekeeping with schedule changes here at AM 950. As you've probably heard all this week, Santita Jackson, who is the daughter of civil rights icon Jesse Jackson, well, Santita is going to be starting a new morning show here on AM 950. It's going to be airing weekdays from 6 until 8 a.m., and that will start on Monday, August 10th, which is this coming Monday, as we are really excited to bring Santita to the AM 950 airwaves. I've had a chance to hear her show a couple of times, and I think you're really, really going to like it. So make sure you tune into that. It'll be every weekday from 6 until 8 a.m. Now, of course, with Santita's show coming to the airwaves, that has impacted some other shows here on the station. So just want to go through some of the schedule changes that you can expect. LE 2.0 radio is now going to be heard every Monday from 2 until 3 p.m. Now, of course, I normally host Mondays from 2 until 3 p.m., but more than willing to let Ellie host those Mondays since I think she has a really good show. I'll still be part of that Monday afternoon, though, as what's going to happen each and every Monday is that I am going to be hosting a top-of-the-hour newscast every Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock that will give you a preview of the week ahead in Minnesota politics. So make sure you tune in for that coming up on Monday. As for the other programs that are going to be impacted with Santita moving to the station from 6 until 8 a.m., Democracy Now!, you're still going to be able to hear that every weekday from 4 until 5 p.m., and The Bradcast, you'll still be able to hear that weeknights from 7 until 8 p.m. All right, we're going to take a break and come back and talk about the child care crisis in Minnesota with Walker Orenstein of MinnPost. That's on the way next here on AM 950.
Thank you.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So one of the industries that has been hit especially hard from the COVID-19 pandemic is, of course, the child care industry. And someone who just wrote a piece on that in MinnPost is Walker Orenstein, as his latest piece is titled, How Minnesota's Child Care Industry Has Managed to Hang On Amid the COVID-19 Pandemic, as he joins us now on the show to talk about this topic, which impacts a lot of people that have young children. Hey, Walker, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Brett. Thank you for having me.
So let's dive into your piece, because this industry has really been hit hard with the coronavirus. And, of course, what really hurt things was that parents started keeping their kids home, and that had business dry up for a lot of child care providers. But I think it is important to point out before we even dive into things that the child care industry was already being hit hard even before the pandemic, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. There was a shortage of providers in a lot of pockets of the state, especially outside of the Twin Cities area. It's a low paid profession. They have trouble enticing people into the job. They have trouble getting people to stay in the job. A lot of the folks who have been in the industry for a long time are starting to retire, and that's an issue. And in the cities, you know, there are spots definitely where there's a shortage, but also it's just the price. And the way that the industry works, the economics of it, is that it's just really difficult to run bigger profits. And so it's a weird, I don't know if paradox is the right word, but it's the people who run these things are not making very much money, and the parents are paying exorbitant amounts. I mean, sometimes it's close to what feels like college tuition levels, you know? And so there was already a really difficult situation in the state that legislators and people in Congress have been, focusing on for years, even prior to this moment.
So you had a chance to speak to a few child care providers from around the state. So can you go through and explain some of the biggest challenges that providers are facing right now with COVID-19?
Yeah, absolutely. So the number one issue is, as you said earlier, when COVID-19 hit, many parents were either working from home, or they might have been laid off temporarily or permanently unemployed. And so when that happened, they pulled their kids out of childcare. And especially during the early days of the scare, some families didn't know if they wanted their kids to be in sort of a group setting like that too. And so, childcare providers, they typically serve infants through four-year-olds. They are private businesses. They rely on the tuition in this instance. And so, because of those small profit margins that I talked about, if you take away children from their business, they just can't make any money. So that was the number one issue. But number two issue, there was also increased costs of buying things. All of a sudden, they had to buy more cleaning supplies. It was also harder to find those things. I talked to a child care provider, Lynn Barton, who has a family child care business in Alexandria. So that's sort of a smaller operation instead of a center. And she said, she'd have to go driving around at night looking for, cleaning supplies or, just COVID-related things for her business. And, she's not getting paid for that time. All of a sudden, she has to go scour everything. If you remember the period, particularly where everything in the world was sold out, you couldn't buy toilet paper. It's these sorts of issues that were providing a big barrier. So it was sort of a double punch. And I know for child care centers or places, so Lynn's smaller business has no employees but her, but a bigger business has more employees. And so they might have had to have even more staffing to deal with the cleaning costs and stuff. So it's not just the supplies itself, but they might have actually had more people in just to look over, make sure everything is clean and sanitary. And so this is all the while they have fewer kids and so fewer income, less income.
We're speaking with Walker Orenstein as he covers government and workforce issues for MinnPost over at MinnPost.com. Recently wrote a piece titled How Minnesota's Child Care Industry Has Managed to Hang On Amid the Pandemic. Now, next question for you here, Walker, is that early in the pandemic, I remember hearing this from a lot of people saying that, well, child care providers are likely to go out of business with the economic downturn that's going to happen with the coronavirus. But a lot of them ended up not going out of business, at least not yet, thanks largely to some government grants and government funding. Can you talk about some of the funding that child care providers were able to receive from both the state and the federal level?
Yeah, definitely. So lawmakers certainly heard those warnings from the industry. You know, I was talking to child care providers in the first weeks of the pandemic who said, I might not be able to last one more week, basically. And so the warnings were dire, and the legislature responded. What they did, the first thing they did is they approved a program called the Peacetime Emergency Grants. It's three rounds of grant payments. It totaled about $40 million total. About $30 million of that came from the state, so the legislature approved that. The Republican-controlled Senate and the DFL-controlled House both sort of agreed that that was an issue they wanted to tackle. And then another $10 million came from the federal government. And so there are various avenues for child care spending from the federal government. Then also I will just say that there are some smaller grant programs around the state from what are called Minnesota Initiative Foundations, which are groups that have a focus on child care outside of the Twin Cities. They had some small grant programs that people accessed. And then above that, lawmakers and the governor really tapped into the CARES Act. That's the federal stimulus package, Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. They used, you know, upwards of $20 million to boost the child care assistance program to pay more reimbursement rates for it's a subsidy. And so providers that are serving low-income families will get reimbursed at a higher rate. Although I will say that they were so low in their reimbursement rates that they were facing federal penalties. They were wildly out of step with what the federal government requires. And so they sort of had to do this in some sense anyway, but they figured out a way to do it with existing federal dollars. But it is a help for child care providers who are going to make more money. And then the last main thing is that on July 7th, the governor announced he would direct another $56.6 million from the CARES Act to child care providers. And I will say the peacetime emergency grants were a little bit more competitive. There was, you know, I think like 14,000 applications, about 5,000 providers actually got them. And so the CARES Act money now, the $56 million, is a little bit more open-ended. It's intended to be just anyone who is sort of eligible, as long as you're currently operating and have been operating since June 15th, you can be eligible for that money. And so, yeah, there was a number of steps to use both state and federal money to intervene in this situation.
And as you were talking to some of the providers from around the state, were they largely thinking that, well, this can help them for at least some time, or was this more of kind of like a Band-Aid solution to a bigger problem? Because this is a big issue, because as you brought up earlier, there are lots of areas of rural Minnesota where they only have like one child care provider in a city or sometimes even in a county. So going back to the funding piece, were they thinking that this could help them at least try to get through things in the short and both the long term, or are there going to be other issues that are going to come up?
Certainly it's a help for the short term. You know, sort of my story, focusing on Lynn Barton and Alexandria. I mean, this is a provider who she's been in the workforce for 22 years. She's done, you know, she's gotten her childcare credentials, associate's degree. She's actually working towards another degree. She's a state approved instructor. She's, you know, she knows her way around the business, and she nearly went out of business. She got peacetime emergency grant. She got some of this extra CARES Act money now. And so she's able to sort of hang on for the time being. So that's certainly been helpful. I will say also that providers have had to cover, you know, a lot of their costs by either foregoing salary or taking other extraordinary steps, you know, taking school-aged children, sort of being creative in how and when they serve. So it's not just the state money, and there's other supports. It's not just the federal money, but they've had to go to pretty big lengths. But the money has certainly helped them, you know, survive for now. And what people in the industry will tell you is that it is a little bit more of a short-term solution. Although, you know, if the economy improves, if unemployment goes down, if we don't have a shutdown, it's possible that folks can kind of get back on track without larger intervention. But the big fear is, you know, if unemployment continues to become worse, you know, people who are at home and not working are not sending their kids into childcare. And also, you know, if we have a shutdown or something like that again, and Minnesota's coronavirus numbers are not exactly trending in the right direction right now, that can also be an issue. And so there is a lot of concern in the industry, and they are pushing for larger interventions. There are some discussions in Congress right now over a larger child care package. U.S. Senator Tina Smith has been actually a big proponent of putting a lot of money into child care. She had a bill earlier this year with Senator Elizabeth Warren on the topic. But I noted in my story that Roy Blunt, who's Republican from Missouri, told the Washington Post on Tuesday that this could be definitely an area of agreement between them. So there isn't sort of a sense of, okay, we did our job, we stepped in, and there's nothing more to be done. I think that people in the industry and lawmakers are sort of considering still further intervention here.
And talking about that further intervention, I know one of the concerns that some of the providers you talked to, especially the one up in Alexandria, was that, well, she had trouble accessing money because she didn't have a business bank account. Or there were other cases where people of color who were child care providers also had trouble accessing funds, being that they generally don't have ties to financial institutions. So, yeah, there certainly are some other challenges that providers are going to be facing, even if we get more funding for them through the government.
Yes, exactly. And I remember earlier in the pandemic, too, there was a concern that that the business model of childcare is just so risky. And so there is such a narrow profit margin that I know people in the industry worried if there was like the financial ties piece, certainly, you know, if I don't have a corporate bank account, or if I, you know, don't have a relationship with a bank or whatever it is, you know, there's also the idea like that a bank or somebody might not want to work with you because it is a risky business. And so I guess the jury might still be out a little bit on that one. But there was a big concern about that early on as well, which just speaks to the status that the child care industry is in, because it's not, you know, any single provider's fault. That was sort of a worry across the entire industry.
And talking with more folks, it sounded like a lot of them were very concerned about another surge in coronavirus cases, being that this could really be a big, big death blow to them if we see another big surge in Minnesota.
Yeah, certainly possible. And, you know, like same issue as earlier, if parents are keeping their kids out because there's a shutdown or something like that, it can be a really big issue. And, you know, I talked to a few providers, and it's worth noting none of them have had huge troubles with the actual virus in their business, which is good to hear. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's less of the concern, and more of the concern is the financial thing. And I will just note that the state released some childcare coronavirus numbers, by the way, that are probably worth noting. And they are pretty low. I think there was something like last week, there was something like 200 or so cases between staff and children across the whole state, which is, you know, you don't want to have any cases, but yeah, it's 233 businesses had at least one case among staff or children. And it was 257 childcare staff and 108 children at their programs have tested positive for COVID-19. So by and large, that hasn't been an enormous barrier, but I think that the worry is with increasing coronavirus, one, safety is obviously an issue, but two, the finances are just a problem. And they do feel a duty to keep working. A lot of the people I talked to said they could have shut down. They potentially could have taken unemployment, but they were asked to stay open. It's a good thing that they want to remind people of. And also they felt sort of like a duty to do it for the families and the kids who needed it.
All right, Walker, one or two more questions for you before we have to wrap things up. I know you've certainly been following this issue for a while with child care providers, and I think another concern it sounded like some of the providers were expressing to you was that even if we do eventually have an economic recovery, at least talking to some of them, they were still telling you that they're going to be facing a lot of persisting issues in the future, even if we do have improved economic conditions. Can you talk about that aspect a little bit?
Yeah, I think that all of the past problems will carry into the future. I mean, there's the rocky finances. They have trouble getting people into the industry. They've got, you know, Most providers I talk to will say rules and regulations from the Department of Human Services are too much for them. They feel like they're a big problem and that they keep people from wanting to be in the business as well. So that's a big issue that they will raise often. And so, it's an industry with some trouble. The family child care providers, which are the small businesses typically run out of somebody's home, there's been a longstanding decline in the number of those, and those particularly serve people in more rural areas. A child care center is larger and it's more central, and those will be more common in cities. But if you live out in a more rural area, you know, you might have to drive, you know, a long ways to a city to find a child care center. And so I think it's an issue that lawmakers are still focused on, and that probably can't just resolve itself without any change, if that makes sense, because I know there are task forces, there are committees looking at this issue every year at the state capitol, and folks from both parties working on the issue. So it's there's going to be issues going forward. And I think that this in some ways has set back the industry. Like, for example, I talked to Karen DeVos, who owns a child care center in Ada, and I think it's the only child care center in her county. And she wanted to open up a second child care center nearby, and she had to put that plan on hold basically for at least a year, is what she told me. And so, you know, this is something she had planned for, she had ready to go, you know, she felt like she was in a good position to do it. And then it's like, okay, wait, this can't happen for a while. So any gains that anybody's been making have probably been at the very least set on hold because of the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is certainly an industry that's been hit hard by the pandemic, but had issues even beforehand. And it really does impact just about every corner of the state with what's happening with the child care industry. We've been speaking with Walker Orenstein. He covers environment and workforce issues for MinnPost over at MinnPost.com. And make sure you read his piece, How Minnesota's Child Care Industry Has Managed to Hang On Amid the Pandemic, over at MinnPost.com. Walker, thanks again for the time today. All right, well, it looks like Walker's phone cut out for us at the very end of the interview. I guess good timing being we at least got the content in there. Hey, coming up on the other side of the break, we are going to switch gears and talk about TikTok. Could it be banned in the U.S.? What would that look like? And how about Microsoft trying to purchase that social media platform? We'll be speaking with a social media expert about all of those big issues with TikTok and other social media platforms coming up next here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. And we're back on AM 950 as you're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, over the past few months or so, the big social media app that has been in the news is, of course, TikTok. That is the video sharing app where people can put together short videos and have those go viral. And that's led to being the fact that it is owned by a Chinese company, American officials having concerns about the privacy of TikTok and the data of Americans being shared with the Chinese government. It's led to possible bans on the app, according to President Donald Trump. But now Microsoft apparently wants to buy TikTok. So joining us now to sort through all of this is Adam Raziri. He is the chief marketing officer for Agency Partner Interactive in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Adam, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Pleasure to be here, sir. Thank you.
Yeah. So tell us, people aren't quite familiar, what exactly is TikTok and why are people so drawn to it?
TikTok is probably one of the most viral social media platforms that's around today. It's basically a video sharing platform that allows people to load everything from, you know, funny cat videos to, hey, look at this cool backflip I can do, to this is a dance move that I just learned and I want to see if you can do it also. So as you can imagine, it's just got all sorts of content on there. And frankly, the Gen Zs are loving it. The millennials are catching on as well. And I've talked to a few baby boomers who are just like, what the heck is TikTok? So it's been really interesting just to see how this has kind of taken hold of the market. And frankly, I think a lot of the social distancing and the pandemic really is to, I guess you can point fingers to it or say it's to blame. It kind of allows people to have more of a social interaction with others who are just not within your same physical space. So, you know, it's been really, I guess, interesting to see how the consumer market's taken hold of it. The business side of it, they just launched their business ad manager in June. So they've really started to create more of a formal way for businesses to start generating revenue from TikTok as a social platform. But of course, as you said, there's a lot of user data that's kind of being collected by this thing, and people are obviously expressing a lot of concerns about how it's being used and just truly how private the things that we share really are.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about some of those security concerns, because TikTok is owned by ByteDance, which is a Beijing, China-based internet technology company, and they do collect quite a bit of data. Can you talk about some of the concerns folks have with the data that is collected?
Brad, it's crazy. So, you know, TikTok being such a big and widely adopted social tool these days, it's got over 2 billion downloads. And from that, about 800 million users or so are active globally. And we're looking at anywhere from 30 to 100 million Americans on TikTok each month, depending on your data source. And so the information that it's capturing on these people, me included, information such as device data, your location, your typical schedule, you know, where does my device move on a daily basis? If they're able to track when I go from home to the gas station, to the grocery store, to the office, and it's also able to track and associate my interactions with others. So on top of all that information, just my basic life, right? It's even copying the information that's on your device clipboard, which sometimes holds information like your passwords. So when you think about it, that's just a ton of information that typically a marketer would use. But noting that the ownership of TikTok being ByteDance, you know, this is a company that's based in Beijing. And as we know, their form of government doesn't allow private ownership like what we have over here. So at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, okay, so the owner of this information, what are they doing with it? And the thing that's really clear, and it's in their privacy policy, TikTok states very clearly that they can share user data with a parent, a subsidiary, or other affiliate of its corporate group. So they're not even trying to hide the fact that they could share your data with the very top of China's leadership. What are they going to do with that?
Is what they collect really too dissimilar from what we see from other social media apps? I mean, obviously, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, others also collect quite a bit of personal data. So is what TikTok, is what they're collecting very much different from what we're seeing on other apps?
That's a great question. And the answer to that is not really. No, you know, the information that most of your social media apps capture, it's pretty robust and it's very specific. The question though is, you know, what rules do those guys play by versus what rules do the companies that are here in the United States play by? Who holds them accountable? And ultimately, you know, what is the result on the consumer market from that? So kind of understanding that you're talking about a nation state now having control over this information versus, say, Mark Zuckerberg and his shareholders at Facebook having control of that information. You know, they have different goals and different layers of accountability, right? When you think about where you're going to invest your money or where you're going to deposit your check, are you going to go to somewhere in Minnesota and know that you can go and withdraw funds? Or are you going to go to Cuba and invest your money in one of those banks and hope to get your money next week? You know, it's kind of that question of accountability.
So we've seen President Donald Trump float the idea of possibly banning TikTok, although he's kind of walked that back over the past few days or so. But being that Trump is Trump, you never know when he could reverse his position yet again on that issue. But my question to you here, Adam, is how could the government effectively ban TikTok? Because it would strike me as being they can't just willy-nilly go and say the app is banned. That's not really how our economy and our system of government works here in this country. So what actions could they take to at least reduce the influence of TikTok or even try to ban it?
Thank goodness we do live in our society, right? We have rights and we have protections, and that's what makes us great. Now, the way that Trump would essentially do this, it would have to be some sort of executive order citing issues of national security. If you look back to July and just look at what India did, they've already banned TikTok from their country for the same exact reason. So at the end of the day, I think we're kind of looking now at a political dialogue that's actually taking place on both sides of the fence. You know, just imagine this, a day when Chuck Schumer and Donald Trump would agree on something, right? that's today. And it's been really interesting to see just the rhetoric behind both the RNC and the DNC as it pertains to really the threat that TikTok imposes on the information and how it's being used specific to, you know, everybody that's on that platform. So like I said, I mean, did hell freeze over? You know, it's kind of crazy to see both sides just in total agreement about the threat that's posed by TikTok. You know, 2016 was a really, really crazy year. Obviously, it was an election year, right? Back in 2016, we saw Russia attack the DNC, and obviously they exposed a lot of the emails in that particular attack. Just last year, the DNC made a move to basically start banning or forbidding their staff from uploading and using an app called FaceApp, which is a Russian app that basically collects and stores specific information about your face.
Oh, gosh, I remember that one, yeah, from back right? about 4 years ago. Yes, yes.
Exactly, exactly. And it was like, it was a really huge app. It went viral. A lot of celebrities were using it. You know, now we're kind of advancing a little bit further, and we're seeing, okay, so we know Russia is a typical aggressor as it pertains to the online world, right? Now we're kind of saying, you know what, China's been kind of an aggressor for a while as well. Now is the time to make sure that we're holding them accountable and that we're protecting ourselves as well. You know, the hard thing too is like, you know, we can take efforts and actions to, you know, to basically boot TikTok or boot the Chinese government out of our day to day. But at the end of the day, we're still going to have that info war battle. The hackers are still out there, you know, and that's going to be a force that we have to sort of reckon with quicker than not.
Have we had the government take any types of similar actions against social media applications in terms of trying to ban them or reduce their influence?
Well, I think we are seeing a lot of moves, especially following last week's, I guess they called it the big tech grilling. You know, you had the four big tech CEOs in the in front of the House Judiciary Committee. And we're finally seeing moves towards regulation and basically kind of making efforts to modernize and update not just antitrust laws, but really just how these players compete and operate. A big part of that, you know, really kind of dials down to the value of social media, which is user data. You know, how are marketers using that information? What sort of exploits do they come up with based on the user data? You know, I think we're seeing a lot of moves towards kind of reconciling what privacy means in our country. And I don't think anything's really finalized yet, but I think we do know one thing, that we don't want guys like China and Russia collecting our information to the extent that they do.
And that was part one of my conversation with Adam Raziere, who is the chief marketing officer with Agency Partner Interactive. He is a social media expert. Coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to take a look at what would happen if Microsoft were to buy TikTok. It's on the way next here on FYI Politics. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Yeah, I just find this conversation about TikTok and what's happening with this company so interesting. So let's get back to it. We are speaking with Adam Raziere. He is the chief marketing officer with Agency Partner Interactive. He is a social media expert. Let's get to part two of the conversation where we're going to be talking more about Microsoft's potential purchase of TikTok. Here it is. So as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the Trump administration does seem to somewhat be walking back the idea of banning TikTok, and a big part of that has to do with the fact that Microsoft is interested in purchasing the U.S. operations of TikTok. So, Adam, as we were just talking about, we have all of these hearings that are taking place in social media companies that are facing all sorts of scrutiny. Now, Microsoft wants to get in the game and buy TikTok for, as what I'm reading here, as much as like $30 billion. Why exactly do they want to do this? It's going to, of course, cost them a heavy price, and then they're likely going to face the same sort of scrutiny that we've seen other social media companies face.
Oh, yeah. You know, Microsoft, they've been trying to kind of be a more of a dominant player in the social media scene for quite some time. If you look back in time, you know, look back to 2007, Facebook was just a three-year-old company. And back at the time, Microsoft invested something like $240 million to get about a 1.3 or 1.6% interest in the business. They earned about $1 billion from that investment. So Microsoft knows there's a lot of value in social media. But the problem is as a company, they've failed so many times when it comes to launching their own social platform. There was a social networking platform called Social that launched in 2012, and that ultimately closed in 2017. It just wasn't really accepted by the market. So, you know, when a company comes in and they see basically another player who's doing things and doing things successfully, it's a much safer sort of move for them to go and try to acquire an already successful business than to literally start one from scratch. Now, you know, Microsoft as a business, I think from a consumer perspective, TikTok would be a huge advantage to them because they could use all of that information to basically channel that data into their R&D system and then generate really cool, innovative and new software and hardware for the market. Stuff that uses augmented reality, stuff that the market, based on the data that they're collecting in TikTok, is most likely to accept. You know, they've done the business thing pretty well, the B2B side of things with LinkedIn. So I think TikTok really just kind of opens up a better door for them to connect with Gen Z and just a lot of consumers that are about to hit the market with frankly, a lot of spending power.
And would the data that would be collected by the app be any more protected under Microsoft? As I'm looking at it here, Microsoft would still be collecting the same sort of data that the app is already doing. It would just be going to Microsoft instead of potentially the Chinese government. Is that kind of the only difference we would see?
For the most part, yeah. You know, I think there's a better layer of accountability there. You know, the thing that's going to make this deal tricky, though, you know, Microsoft's not trying to buy all of TikTok. They're just trying to buy really the U.S. assets of TikTok, also Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. So the deal itself has to get done first, right? And frankly, that's going to be a challenging deal to put together. Like you said, it's going to cost a fair sum of money. You know, check the cushions of the couch and see if you got it, right? But the end result for the average consumer, if Microsoft ends up buying TikTok, just a little bit more certainty about where the data is being stored physically here in the United States. You know that there are going to be a lot of strong efforts behind protecting that user data. You also know that there's accountability. So if there is, you know, a terrible leak of some sort, or if the data is, you know, used for unscrupulous purposes, we can at least hold somebody accountable. The threat, though, is always going to be there. Whether Microsoft owns it or whether you own it, the Chinese can still go after it, right? They have a really, really big hacking operation. And Brett, I'll be serious. So I actually went through the process of creating a TikTok business account. I didn't fully verify the account, but I got halfway through it, right? Mm-hmm. Within that same week, I have 3 Google business profiles. Each profile started getting attacked by Chinese IP addresses, basically attempts to try and ultimately gain ownership of my business profiles. You know, I've been in business since 2010. This has never happened, but it did happen the week that I tried to onboard TikTok business.
Well, that raises certainly some red flags. Well, 3 times. That is absolutely crazy.
It's crazy. And the attacks, they continue. There have been multiple attacks on all 3 business pages, and the most recent one was yesterday afternoon.
Wow. So, yeah, maybe that is pretty unreal. If the deal does end up falling through with Microsoft, are we kind of back to square one where we're looking at another ban of the app?
Yeah, probably we are. Now, if the deal does fall through, the unfortunate thing in the immediate is you're going to have some Americans that do lose their jobs. I don't recall the specific number of Americans that are employed by TikTok in the U.S. I think it's maybe a couple thousand or so. But don't quote me on that particular number. In the short term, people will lose some jobs. TikTok will be gone. And ultimately, people are going to find another way to spend their time. But if you look to Uber as an app, right? Uber was in Austin, Texas for quite some time. The city of Austin basically kicked Uber out. And from that came a new, very similar app called Ride Austin. So let's just say TikTok gets kicked out. In the immediate, there's going to be some downtime and some difficulty. But in the long term, something new and something very cool will come right back.
Yeah, we're already seeing, I think, Instagram trying to launch their own kind of competitor to TikTok. So you're right, something will probably come up. What do you make of Instagram launching their own kind of competitor to TikTok?
No surprise, right? I mean, you know, Instagram's owned by Facebook. Facebook's really a very aggressive company when it comes to their growth strategy. They and this was actually a big topic back in the antitrust hearings, but they are known to acquire their competitors. They're known to acquire companies that might augment their existing operations. And they really kind of, I guess they called it a M&A land grab. So like a mergers and acquisitions land grab, almost like real estate, right? So don't be surprised to see companies like Facebook constantly try and basically replicate what's out there that's being used with success. Because ultimately, they're going to try and compete just as aggressively as they can, leveraging the capital and really all the brain power they have in those offices.
And a final question here for you, Adam, and that is, how does TikTok necessarily get its value where it could be worth up to $30 billion? Is it just from the data that they store, or I think you were alluding this earlier, they are running ads for businesses? Just talk about how they actually get that value where it can be worth that much money in such a short amount of time.
That's a lot of fun coupons, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a lot of fun coupons. You know, there's a few layers to the value here. The first layer, of course, is the user data. This data is so specific that basically TikTok can say, hey, listen, we have this customer profile. We know XYZ about this customer profile. Hey, Mr. Marketer, this is how you should market to these people, and they'll probably buy from you. So they're basically able to kind of pair up advertisers and publishers and direct them at the exact target market that's going to most likely buy from them. So from an advertising perspective, there's a huge ad revenue opportunity there. And frankly, Google's already doing this. Facebook's already doing it as well. But TikTok just launched their business ad manager in June. So this thing is fresh, right? And that's immediate revenue for whoever the buyer is. We'll just say Microsoft. The next layer of value, there's obviously a great ability to stream content through TikTok. Microsoft as a business has been wanting a better content syndication platform, something that would actually allow them to compete with, you know, Google's YouTube and of course Facebook as well. So when you look at kind of the competitive, the competitive environment of the big tech firms, this really kind of brings Microsoft to light as a much stronger player, specifically in social and in the consumer spending world. The next thing, of course, is leveraging that user data to connect with the Gen Z to build out the future of really cool software and really cool hardware, really buying what people want and doing so with the information that says this investment and this project is the least risky way to go to be successful. So there's a ton of value.
Hey, Adam, actually, one more question before we wrap things up. So if Microsoft does buy TikTok, they're certainly going to face a whole lot of headaches that other social media platforms have been facing. Of course, Microsoft was infamous from a couple of decades ago facing antitrust actions. And are you kind of thinking the same thing could happen yet again if this buyout does go through?
Looking into my marketer's crystal ball, you know, just kind of looked at 10 years from now, maybe a decade from now, and ultimately just kind of recognizing what the acquisition of TikTok could do for Microsoft from a competition perspective. Yeah, absolutely. They could find themselves basically in another antitrust hearing because the way that TikTok could help them compete against Google and Facebook could actually become something that actually is unfair based on the amount of user data that is held by TikTok. Like I said, 800 million users in TikTok now, and it's still growing, plus all these different layers of value. If Microsoft, noting the brain power that they have, I mean, Satya Nadella is a really, really smart CEO. I'm sure he could use that user data to grow the company in such a way that does make them kind of another beast of the future. So, you know, buckle up. I think we'll probably see the House Judiciary Committee having very similar conversations, assuming things don't change fast enough with the existing Congress, as it pertains to their current conversations around antitrust reform. It's going to be a really, really interesting decade ahead. It's going to be really cool to watch.
Well, we'll have to see what happens in the coming weeks and months with this potential buyout of the U.S. operations of TikTok by Microsoft. We've been speaking with Adam Rizzieri. He is the Chief Marketing Officer for Agency Partner Interactive. Adam, really appreciate the time today. Good stuff.
My pleasure, sir. Thank you so much.
All right, and I am just about out of time for today. A reminder, coming up on Monday, the start of our new broadcast schedule. The Morning Drive with Santita Jackson going to be airing starting on Monday and every weekday from 6 until 8 a.m. And don't forget, you'll now be able to catch Ellie 2.0 Radio on Mondays from 2 until 3 p.m. You can find that full schedule over at am950radio.com with all of the changes that we've made.